www.annieecasey.org and the Annie E. Casey Foundation.
Thank you for listening. I'm Norman B. and this is WMNF and this is Radioactivity. Thank you so much for joining me. We have just an incredible lineup of guests for you today, and I want to hear from you. Now let's talk about something that's, gosh, in the second half of the show, I want to talk about money. If I gave you a challenge, let's say $1 million, what could I get you to do for $1 million? Maybe that's not enough. Maybe I should give you $5 million. What would you do for five? Maybe it would take more. What about, let's say $20 million? How far would you go for $20 million? Think about it. We'll talk about that in 30 minutes. First, another challenge for you. I want you to take a good look at your body. Yeah, I'm serious. Scrutinize your own body. Look at how it's put together. Move your arms. Move your legs. Move your fingers. Move whatever you like. And you've got to agree, it's sort of amazing how we take for granted the mechanics of our bodies. It gives our bodies their shape and the ability to move. And arguably, no other part of the human anatomy has such rich scientific and cultural significance, both brimming with life and it's a potent symbol of death. So there you are. I want you to talk to me in a little bit later on. I'm going to talk to Brian right now. But get ready, because we're going to have some conversations very soon. Here's some music to get us underway as you get comfortable. Is Brian Sweetick. His new book is titled Skeleton Keys, The Secret Life of Bone. Brian, welcome to WMNF.
Oh, thank you for having me on.
I have got to tell you something, and I could make a big issue out of this, I guess, but I was in the gym just a little while ago, a couple of hours ago, and I think I wrote a little piece about this on Twitter, is that I can't look at my body the same anymore, and I certainly can't look at anybody else's body the same after reading your book. You've changed my way of thinking. Did you do that deliberately?
You know, I was trying to. I was hoping that I would, particularly in the sections about, you know, just taking a moment to think about, you know, what your bones are doing
at
any given moment. So I'm certainly happy to hear that I've changed at least your perspective.
What a fascinating book, Brian. You've written this book, Skeleton Keys. It's all about bones, and particularly about our bones, human bones. And I'm fascinated by this topic, and obviously you are. I think I read in your bio somewhere that when you were a very young person, you were really into sort of studying fossils and like a fossil fanatic. Is that right?
Yeah, I've made a career about this. So most of my writing career up until now, over the past 10 years or so, is focused on dinosaurs and, you know, prehistoric mammals and other, you know, vertebrates with these really, you know, bizarre or ornate body plans. And I realized that I hadn't really thought very much about our own skeletons. I've paid lots of attention to skeletons like that of, you know, T-Rex or Stegosaurus or saber-toothed cats or things like that, but I didn't know very much about our own. So I wanted to take a sort of paleontologist's perspective and apply it to human anatomy, the sort of questions that we ask about ancient animals in terms of, okay, well, where did that bone go, and what does it identify this creature as, and how did it move, and, you know, how did it heal, and, you know, all these things that we think about when we're starting just from the bone itself, and apply that to human anatomy.
Yes, and you start the book off with a topic and a place that I'm fascinated by, Dr. Muta and his museum in Philadelphia. That's a great starting place, isn't it? Because of all the strange things that that they've got there collected in the cases. In you talk about that. Did you deliberately want to sort of go in that direction to begin with, so we would sort of understand that there are so many sort of variants in how what we are and who we are as humans?
I mean, that was part of my goal, but why I started at the Muta Museum was because, you know, I went on this trip. I put together a tour sort of in the winter of 2015 to different museums all up and down the East Coast that had bones, and particularly human bones, displayed, just to see what I can learn, what struck me. Some of these places that I'd heard about but never been to. You know, I live in Utah now, but I grew up in New Jersey, you know, not too far from Philadelphia. But I'd never been to that museum, so I wanted to make a point to get there. And I really loved that it was sort of a time capsule of a very different kind of museum, and it was kind of maintained in this 19th century aesthetic. And just seeing that wall of human skulls was, you know, somewhat unsettling, both for, you know, how these skulls were accumulated and brought together, and you're just seeing all those, you know, vacant eye sockets staring back at me, but also every person there, every skull represented, you know, a life, you know, yeah, a story. And I start the book with a particular person that, you know, he tried to take his own life by slitting his throat. He found that he,
yes,
could do that because part of his larynx had turned to bone. And that's something that, you know, soft tissue, something that we think of as pliable, you know, started to turn skeletal. And that actually saved his life, that, you know, he wasn't successful, or he, you know, did not,
yeah,
you know, follow through and, you know, survived, and says, you know, the little placard under his skull says that, you know, he was happy for the rest of his life. And
yeah,
I just thought that was just a great embodiment of, you know, the vitality of bones, and that it is this not only permanent thing but incredibly dynamic.
I love that you included that, because it's sort of not necessarily spine chilling, but it's kind of horrific at the same time. It's just a scary thing. Well, the whole museum is kind of scary, as you say. We're talking to Brian Swietek. His new book is called Skeleton Keys: The Secret Life of Bone. Brian, as I'm reading your book, and I guess when I got to the end of it, it's dawned on me that we take our bones for granted, don't we? We don't really pay much attention to them until something goes wrong.
Yeah, we do. It's much like many of our, you know, systems and tissues in our bodies that we don't really notice, you know, what's going on until something starts to go a little bit haywire. But even just what our bodies can do and what it allows, you know, I think we don't think about quite often. I know I didn't until I was going through the process of writing this book. So, for example, you know, the way that we, you know, so much of our culture is based around what we can build and what we can create with our hands, whether we're constructing something like a building, or whether I'm typing away at my computer,
yeah,
or someone's making a painting, or even, you know, sports like, you know, baseball or something like that. It's allowed by the fact that we have these incredibly flexible limbs, that I'm able to hold my arm out and, you know, hold my palm down, but then turn it palm up, or
yes,
that I can, you know, swing overarm. All these things that we inherited, not only from our skeletal format, but the sort of ancestry of, you know, humans that came before us, who, you know, about 4 million years ago were living in the trees,
yes,
and, you know, hadn't yet descended onto the ground, and how it didn't have to be that way. If we look at other primates, for example, that they can't manipulate things the same way that we do, or do, you know, as many of the same constructive things that we do. So just these little quirks of history that gave us our skeletal format, that, as you say, let us take it for granted, really, you know, life could be very, very different if our skeletal format were changed or we didn't have that flexibility. One of my favorite examples is there used to be this thought experiment about what would dinosaurs be like if they survived to the modern era. And this paleontologist came up with this idea of the dinosauroid, this thing that looks like one of the flea stacks from Land of the Lost, you know, very humanoid, you know, bulging head and, you know, stacked on top of an upright spine,
yeah.
And, you know, as this ideal version of, you know, what evolution would produce with greater intelligence. Well, we've actually run through this experiment in real life because birds are living dinosaurs, and there's some crow species that are able to not only make tools, but make tools that make other tools, and they do it with beaks and claws and wings.
Right.
But they don't make the same things that we do.
We
so
do.
Imagine, you know, if we hadn't evolved or something like us hadn't, but we were left with, you know, today's very intelligent dinosaurs, what kind of structures or buildings or culture would they create? It'd probably be very different, and that's in part determined by our different skeletal builds. So it's not only, you know, these systems inside of us are so vital that we take for granted, it really underpins so much of what our culture and society looks like based upon what we're capable of.
Yes, yes. Gosh, you explained that so well, and I'm glad that you talked about evolution, because there's chapter 4 that I wanted to focus in on. Chapter 4 is titled Bone Shaking, and you talk about Lucy. For my listeners that are not quite familiar, can you just give a little overview of who Lucy was?
Yeah, so Lucy is one of the most famous skeletons in paleoanthropology. So the actual species name is Australopithecus afarensis. This is someone, an ancient human who lived around about, you know, 3.4 million years ago in eastern Africa. And, you know, at the time, part of what made Lucy so famous is because we didn't really have very many early human fossils at all. We had, you know, plenty of Neanderthals and, you know, relatively later Ice Age people, but not, you know, very many prehistoric humans that fit in between relatively modern humans and our ape ancestors. So Lucy seemed to be right in the middle. And when you look at the skeleton of Lucy, you can see a lot of resemblances to ourselves, but it's almost like she's two halves of that are different creatures, almost. We know that the skeleton goes together. It was all found together, and we found other specimens since that confirm this. But the top half of her body is very much adapted to life in the trees, like very long arms, very curved fingers, still being able to climb and grasp. But the bottom half of her body is very much adapted to walking on the ground, walking upright, you know, this sort of back and forth that we have with our legs, not knuckle walking, not an odd shuffle, but walking upright the same way that we do today. And how this really defined the ways in which we move, you know, gave us limits but also possibilities in terms of just the mechanics of how we can move around.
Yeah, yes. Well, the whole book is fascinating, and if I say that word many times, I'm not going to apologize, because it is fascinating.
Well, it is. I mean, the fact is that this is a relatively, you know, short course in bones and anatomy and osteology. If I wrote, you know, everything that's fascinating about bone in a single book, the book would be 6 feet tall,
yes,
not fit to be read by
right,
anybody. So
yeah.
I tried to just kind of give a taste of these different ideas, but that's the wonderful thing about it, that it is, you know, so vital and so present, and we know such a great deal about it that, you know, we're learning new things every single day, and I'm sure we're going to continue for quite some time, even just about this thing that lives inside of all of us.
Right. There's something about your book that I want to point out to my listeners, and that is the way you've written the book. You inject a little bit of humor in it. You manage to sort of make it. It's sometimes you get these kind of books talking about things that are sort of, I guess, scientific and sort of. There's lots of information, and sometimes they're a bit dry. But you've managed to do this in a very, I'm not going to say jokey way, but you've certainly got some style going on here, which I think is very readable. Do you know, Brian, there's something you touch on in the book which I'd like to explore a little bit, and that's that there's no way that we can know from bones about racial makeup of somebody. That's something which bones hide, don't they?
That's right, and it's something that I think, you know, helps confirm, you know, the unity of humanity, and that, you know, we're all shaded together, that, you know, there's no way to make, you know, these very stark divisions that were thought to exist, that, you know, race really is a societal and a cultural concept, and biologically it's not there. And that takes us, you know, to the early days of anthropology, because anthropology, particularly in America, started out being very concerned with racial divisions. It was a racial science, and that there are thought to be five races of people, and that people could be not only divided but ranked on the basis of certain physical characteristics. And this wasn't something that was, you know, observed, you know, objectively. This was basically a cultural belief that basically there's people, you know, in a position of power saying that, well, you know, of course, you know, light-skinned people should be at the top, and everybody else should be ranked below, and maintaining that, you know, sense of control and that sense of power. And then, you know, when people actually looked at, you know, the variability that exists in our bones, in our skeletons, in our biology, those divisions that were thought to be, you know, so apparent totally disappeared, and people are actually resistant to this. There's a anthropologist by the name of Franz Boas who worked in New York at the beginning of the 20th century, and he wanted to check to see, you know, because there's a large influx of immigrants to, you know, that area of the country, you know, at that time. And he, you know, looked at skull measurements and head shape, and, you know, between, you know, immigrant families, the parents and the children, and he found that, you know, all these things that we used to think were dividing factors, or were these clear markers of race, or, you know, where somebody came from, they don't hold up. That, you know, we're incredibly sort of a squishy and variable, you know, species. And the anthropological community didn't pay attention to this. In fact, some of them even misconstrued the findings, say, well, maybe a new American race is starting to evolve, and, you know, this hardier stock in North America is starting to become apparent. It wasn't until after World War II and the horrors of the Holocaust that anthropologists really saw, you know, where this kind of racial thinking can go and the damage that it can cause. And, you know, it started to be recognized that, you know, basically we found divisions because we were looking for them. When we take away that concept and that sort of theoretical framework that had always been in operation, we don't see those divisions. We only see connection.
Gosh, you know, as you're saying that, I'm thinking about all the horrible things that must have gone on or have gone on over the years, based on sort of bogus ideas. It's sort of mind-boggling when you think about it. We're talking to Brian Swietek. His book is a must-read. I've got to tell you this, Brian, it really is. Skeleton Keys, The Secret Life of Bone. Now, in your book, you as I said earlier, you cover so much, and you could have, as you said, made this book 6 foot tall, because if you put everything in, the editing process is always an interesting one for me. And I'm wondering for you, Brian Swietek, was that an issue for you when you started out on the journey to write this book? Did you say to yourself, oh gosh, there's so much to put in here, how am I going to chop it all down and put it into one readable book?
Absolutely. That was definitely a struggle from the start, especially coming from a paleontology background and a, you know, background that was more versed in the skeletons of other animals rather than humans. So I didn't know terribly much about archaeology or anthropology, and I had to, you know, go back to some of the courses that I, you know, used to take when I was in college, yeah, and, you know, back to some of the textbooks and give myself this ground-up you know, education in some of these other fields, but also, you know, at the same time, come at it as an outsider, and what I saw as, you know, certain trends or cultures, like in science, how do I relate to that or not? And in terms of what went in the book and what got cut out, I wanted to try and pick a representative skeleton or body for each chapter to be centered around as a sort of example of a concept, because I wanted readers to come away with, you know, the sense that, you know, these are all the different stories that bones can tell, and depending on your perspective or where you're starting from, you know, the story that you focus on might be a little bit different. If I tried to just make it about bone in general, you know, there would have been no way through, no way to really organize this. It would have been, you know, a textbook or a list of facts. So even though it's not necessarily a complete view of everything about bones, what I really want to do is build up this argument that we often think about bones in terms of death and the afterlife, because we only really see them, yes, you know, after life has passed away, unless you get an x-ray or a CAT scan now for some reason. But that it's this dynamic, responsive, living tissue that also records our own stories, and that it may be all that's left of us, you know, for millions of years to come in the future. So, you know, bones as these sort of very vital time capsules, and picking stories that built that argument.
God, that's so important. That's so well said. Was there a surprise for you as you wrote this book, and as you said, you're doing your research and putting the information together? Did you come across something which made you stop in your tracks?
I think the thing that I was most fascinated by, just in terms of the makeup of our own skeletons, are the bones that we've lost. Because I started the chapter, I think it's the second chapter in the book, talking about the sort of assembly of the human skeleton. So yeah. Over evolutionary time, you know, over the past 500 million years or so, how all those different pieces came together, how, you know, skeletons made of flexible materials came before the tissue bone, and how those skeletons then became mineralized, and, you know, how we wound up with four limbs instead of two or six or some other number. But I was really struck by things like scleral rings. So these are rings in the eyes of animals like fish and some reptiles and, you know, dinosaurs. You can see them in some skeletons of museum mounts. And our ancestors used to have them, proto-mammals, these little weasel-like things called cynodonts that lived over 200 million years ago. And there's something about when dinosaurs started to take over and become dominant, and mammals became small and, you know, diversified at smaller body sizes, when, you know, the proto-mammals had basically been knocked from their own dominance and the reptiles were taking over. Something about becoming miniature caused us to lose, or our ancestors to lose, those bones that were in their eyes. And I just was kind of tickled by that thought of, you know, what would it be like today if that never happened, if we retained those bones, if you went to the emergency room with a broken eye bone, or, or, you know, something that you had to deal with in your own medical history. So I was really, you know, taken by not only the bones that we've added, but the bones that our ancestors had that have been lost over time.
Yeah, and I guess an obvious one would be a tail, wouldn't it?
Yeah, we still have the remnants of that. Another one, you know, not to get, you know, too blue over the radio, but, you know, our ancestors had genital bones.
Yes.
We see these in other primates, the baculum in males and the balbellum in females. And following the sort of culture of science that we were talking about, the baculum, or the male equivalent, has been much more studied than the female one. And that's something that needs to be, you know, rectified in the culture of science, but that our mammalian and, you know, primate ancestors had these bones that were lost over, you know, evolutionary time, and, you know, all these other bits and pieces that, you know, can either connect us to other organisms, or it's like those old games where they give you two pictures and, like, find the differences, where you can look at another skeleton and pick out those parts that don't exactly match up.
Yeah. I have to ask you this, Brian, and that is, as somebody that was, from an early age, you were just fascinated by fossils, a fossil addict. And new fossils, from what I understand, are being discovered all the time. But is it possible that there will be a discovery of yet another skeleton along the lines of the importance of Lucy?
Probably. I mean, every couple of years, there seems to be another one. I think, oddly enough, the skeleton that anthropologists are most after are of some of the earliest chimpanzees, because we have almost no fossil chimpanzee skeletons. We know that their fossil record must be as long as that of humans, because we split from them. Our last common ancestor was about 5 million years old, so we have a fair number of fossil humans now, but we don't have a lot of other fossil apes, and there's been some question, in fact, about whether some early human fossils might actually be fossil apes that are non-human, and we need those other fossils to be able to tell that. So that's one area. But the fact is that, you know, anytime when you're going through an evolutionary series or looking at this evolutionary bush of all the, you know, fossil humans that have existed through time, every time that you find one and you say, okay, this is where I think it fits, you create a gap in which, you know, there's something else in between, or there might be a whole variety of prehistoric human that we had no idea about whatsoever. So, for example, there was a finger bone from Eurasia, and this was genetic analysis, but this group of people called the Denisovans that we had no idea existed before. They were only discovered because of paleogenetic evidence, and we're still on the fossil trail of who these people were and what their culture was. So I think with the human fossil record in particular, there could certainly be another fossil that, you know, helps fill in some critical part of our own backstory or shows another way to be human that we never expected. It's kind of odd in its own way that, you know, the human fossil record goes back about 5 million years. We're the only one left. At various points in the past, there have been, you know, up to 5 or more different species of human present on the planet all at the same time. And we've lost all that, and now we're the only ones left. And that kind of forms our expectations when we're looking at this record, because we're always looking for our own ancestors. But the fact is that there are other kinds of fossil humans that don't really look very much like us at all. And maybe there are others out there.
Goodness.
I hope we find out.
Well, now that leads me to a question which I can't have you on the air and not ask you about the horrible thing of the black market, or is it the red market, in human skeletons and bones. Can you just quickly give us a little overview on that?
Sure. So the red market is a term that was coined by journalist Scott Carney, if I remember correctly, for the trade in human body parts, you know, everything from blood to hair to organs to bones. And it's still quite vibrant, in places particularly like China and India. Even though there might be local export bans on human remains, some of those skeletons still wind up in the United States or elsewhere around the world in private collections. In India, there are many medical schools that will encourage students to get a real human skeleton for their studies to learn anatomy, and that kind of fuels some of this trade, you know, bodies that are stolen from their last resting places and then denuded of flesh so they can be sold on the market. It's even as close, you know, as your smartphone in your pocket, you know, Instagram. If you know the right hashtags to follow, you can find human remains for sale, you know, most of which are of questionable origin, but once they've gotten, you know, to the United States, they can be sold. But as a friend of mine pointed out to me, like, you know, she was thinking about buying one of these things, and I was able to talk her out of it. And at the end of it, she said, you know what, I've given more thought to, you know, the treatment of the chickens who lay the eggs that I buy at the grocery store than about buying a person or the remains of a person. So this is something that, you know, even though we'd like to think that this was, you know, 19th century kind of looter mentality, it's still there and still with us and still something to be reckoned with.
Oh, God, yes. Glad I asked you that question. I've got one last question for you, Brian.
And, sure.
And this is it might even sound like a crazy question, and that is, has bone changed over time? Has it evolved?
Certainly so, yes. Partially in what bones can do, and it's important to think of bones as, you know, part of your integrated system. It doesn't exist in a vacuum. So, for example, if you're very stressed or you're malnourished, you know, when you're very young, it will stunt your skeleton and affect, you know, how you grow.
Yeah.
Looking even back further in time, evolutionary time, the first bone about 455 million years ago in our fishy ancestors, it didn't have cells in it. It wasn't as responsive or reactive as our current bones are. It was a material called aspidin, and it was much more like teeth. It was basically this outer armor that just cemented on and protected these fish and eventually transformed into the responsive and dynamic tissue that, you know, now props us up. So, you know, the tissue bone, even though it's been relatively stable for, you know, a long period of time, many millions of years, and allowed, you know, the evolution of everything from us to, you know, our favorite dinosaurs, the fact is that the way that bone interacts with bodies is constantly evolving.
Goodness. There is so much that I'd love to talk to you about, but unfortunately, time is always up against us. The book is called Skeleton Keys, The Secret Life of Bones. Brian Swietek has been my guest. Brian, it's a wonderful book. I highly recommend it. Thank you so very much for joining us.
Oh, this has been so fun. Thank you so much.
Them bones gonna walk around. Them bones gonna walk around. Them bones gonna walk around. Now hear the word of the Lord. Disconnect them bones, them.
Ike Riley, star of Tropical Heatwave and longtime WMNF favorite, is returning to Tampa and the Attic in Ybor City on March 28th.
She haunts my hideout.
Riley's witty, edgy songwriting and skills as a comic rock on tour will shine when experienced in a solo session in the intimate listening room setting at the Attic in Ybor City.
Tell me, mama, tell me about God and money. I really gotta know what happened to your soul.
You don't want to miss the show opener at 8 p.m. Siobhan Philidor.
It's time to let go.
That's Ike Riley at the Attic in Ybor City, Thursday night, March 28th. Capacity is limited, so get your tickets now at the event page at WMNF.org.
That sounds good, doesn't it? Oh, my goodness. I'm Norman B., and this is Radioactivity. It is, where are we? It's 11:35, according to the digital clock in front of me on a Friday. Happy Friday to you. That was interesting, talking to Brian Sweetick about bones. Now, let's talk. Let's have a conversation. Let's find out your thoughts on money. Now, my discussion about money that I want to share with you came about after watching the controversial documentary Leaving Neverland. That's about Michael Jackson and two young men he's alleged to have sexually abused. Now, even if you haven't seen this doc, I'm sure you've heard more than enough about it. And the big question I had after watching the full two-part series was, how could a parent knowingly leave their young son to sleep and travel with a man in his 30s? And the question kept bothering me. Was it really all about money? Because one of the boy's parents got a house paid for by Jackson. They traveled first class all over the place, and they were not strapped for cash when they were in Michael Jackson's world. And one of the young men appears to have gotten very successful. He got a career footing by being around Jackson. And his sister also seems to have managed to live a rather comfortable life because of the pop idol. I could go on with examples, but I think you get the drift. So my question is, what's the price you'll accept for doing or behaving in a way which you know is questionable? Is there an amount of money that you would accept to look the other way? Could you be paid to ignore what you know has to be suspect? Maybe you believe you can't be bought, but I think the lure of a vast amount of money has to be tempting to some people. What are your thoughts about that? I would really like to know. So, here are the telephone numbers. 813-239-9663. That's the telephone number. Comes right in here to the studio. Here's the text number, 813-433-0885. And, of course, you can email to dj@wmnf.org. And don't forget, if you send a text, make sure you pop in your name there, because it's always nice to sort of mention your name rather than a telephone number. So what do you think? How much money would it take for you to do something that you know is questionable? I'm not saying that you would let your child sleep with a pop star when they're just 7 and he's 30-something. I'm not suggesting that, but I do think there is a fine line where some people, how much money would it take? For instance, would you commit a robbery for a certain amount of money if you knew you get paid at the end of it? Would you damage something? Would you maybe, if somebody said to you, look, I'll pay you a lot of money just to go and mess up something, because I feel like I want that, whatever it is, messed up. There has to be people out there that would do that, and I'm wondering whether you would, and what are your thoughts about that? Do people do things out of spite for money? Is that what it takes? Because I'd like to know. 813-239-9663 is the telephone number. The Michael Jackson documentary, of course, is where I got this sort of thought about money and how much you would do for money, or what you would do for money. What would it take? I don't know that. I mean, I've been thinking about it. I got a teenage son, and he's the love of my life. He's so precious, even though he's a moody teenager. But could I imagine letting my son go and sleep overnight and travel with a grown man? I don't think so. But why did these people do this? Was it just about money? What do you think? I'd love to hear from you. I do think that there are people listening right now that have possibly been in the situation where somebody's offered them a large amount of money to do something that they know is wrong, that they know is objectionable. It might even be against the law. I don't know. But I would really, really like to know what you happen to think about that, because it's a question that in this day and age, I think we do need to find out about. We do need to question ourselves, because morals seem, in some respects, sort of gone the other way. And let's not sort of get off on picking on certain people, but it does seem that we're living in a very strange world right now where morals are sort of something which, well, maybe some people have forgotten about. Money. Would you do anything for money? Could I give you... Just imagine for a moment, could I give you enough money that you'd go and scratch the bus's car? Would you do that? Say I gave you $1,000. How much would it take? $1 million? I don't know. Let's find out from Keelan in St. Petersburg. Good afternoon to you, Keelan. Hello, Keelan. Well, maybe you're not there then. Well, let's try Rich in Temple Terrace. Let's talk to Rich in Temple Terrace. Rich, good afternoon to you. Well, okie doke. That's so funny how that works sometimes. All right, here's the telephone number. It's 813-239-9663. That's the telephone number. 813-433-0885. That's the text number. And make sure that you give us a text with your name. It's always important. Put your name in there. And, of course, you can email to dj@wmnf.org. I really would like to hear from you about this, about money. What would you do for money? How much would you do? It's such an interesting thing if you think about how much money would it take for you to do something really objectionable. Would you do anything at all? There's no money at all? Could you do anything? What about that? I'd love to know. Let's see. We're going to go to some more phones and see if we can find out. We're just having a little bit of a problem, I do believe, with some of the telephone lines here this morning, but that's not a problem. We'll get to it in a few moments. So let's find out. 813-239-663 is the telephone number, and I'd like to hear from you. What would it take for you? How much money would it take for you to do something that you know is questionable? It might not be breaking the law. It might just be, well, as I said, something that is kind of, well, immoral. Is that a word that we can use? Is that a word that you would find acceptable to be paid, what, a lot of money? Let's go to Rich in Temple Terrace and see what he has to say. Rich, good afternoon to you. Okay, well, that's not there either. So we've got a lot of lines lighting up here, I tell you. And so Frank, my board producer, is going, he's going to kick the machinery around, I do believe. 813-239-9663 is the telephone number. 813-433-0885 is the text line. And you can email me at it's WMNF.org. All right, let's find out. Let's go to see if we can take Frank. Can you see if you can get that on for us?
That's what I'm doing.
So, Frank, oh, I should tell you this. I'm going to take a picture of it. Frank is standing right by me and he's wearing a t-shirt that says Shelter from the Norm. It's a fabulous t-shirt. Wouldn't have thought of that myself. All right, let's see. Let's go to, we've got so many calls coming in here and I've got to get them on the line here. So, all right, Frank, what do you think? Going to give a shot. Okay, that's Let's go there. Good afternoon. Welcome to WMNF. Okay, apparently, we just got a dead phone line, apparently. Or phone lines, for that matter. Well, it's okay. Don't worry about it, Frank. Don't sweat over there. It's okay. It's bothering him, he says. I'm going to keep on talking about this, because if you've seen this documentary about Michael Jackson and these two young men that allege that Michael Jackson sexually abused them. As you're watching the documentary, it turns out one of the things that you see, first of all, is that both of these men are talking in sort of, it seems like, isolated rooms, and it's very, the camera sort of pans around them. And they tell you these gruesome details, they tell you this and they tell you that, and then gradually the camera sort of pulls back and it gives you the bigger picture of who these people are and what they've done and what's happened in their lives. And there's something about it that made me think, were they, not them particularly, but maybe as they got older, but were their parents in unison with this? Were their parents aware? Their parents had to have been knowledgeable about what was going on. And how much would their parents allow? Which then leads me to ask the question, how much would you allow? What would be your question? What would be your stopping point? Say your son, your young son meets a pop idol and he's infatuated with him, it seems. Even that itself, to me, would be kind of questionable. You'd have to say to yourself, I don't know that I want my son being looked upon by a pop idol as a sort of a friend. It's a bit creepy, for one thing. And two, you gotta say to yourself, oh, hold on a second here, this is not right. Okay, should we go to the phones? Frank, you can speak here.
Let's see if it works. I'll go to Dan in St. Petersburg.
Okay. All right, sounds good. Sounds good. Okie doke. Dan in St. Petersburg, let's put you on the air. Hello there.
Yeah, can you hear me?
Hey, I can hear you, Dan. We got through. I think we've knocked the monkeys out of the works there. We've got it all sort of figured out, apparently. What's going on for you, Dan? Welcome to WMNF.
Yeah, beautiful day. Yeah, I'm hearing you about this Michael Jackson money and all this moral issues concerning this. Another factor I don't think that you've addressed is the idea of glamour. The glamour.
Yes. Yes.
Of it, that, you know, if it was just a man with a lot of money,
yeah.
I doubt if any of these parents would have allowed that.
Yes.
But this is a very famous American icon,
right?
You know, in the league of Elvis and all the others before him and after him, and that had a lot to do. I'm sure that has a lot to do with it.
Do you think?
On the end, you know,
yeah.
well aware that I had a friend in South Florida years ago who was an escort or call girl, for lack of better description, and she said that most of the women she worked with were married. And their husbands drove them to their, quote, dates. And they told their husband that they were only doing lingerie shows. And she said that most of the husbands actually knew what was going on. But because of the money was so good, that they went into denial about it.
Yeah, that's a...
You know?
Dan, that is such a good point. I really appreciate you taking the time to call us. Dan makes a really good point there. Thank you very much for calling us. Now let's find out what Grace has to say in St. Petersburg. Grace, good afternoon to you. Hello, Grace.
Yes, good afternoon, Norman. How are you?
I'm good. I'm good. You don't sound like a Grace to me. You sound. Are you a Grace or are you?
I sound like a Gerald.
Yes, you do.
Well, I've given birth 7 times.
Oh, okay. All right, then.
So unless Gerald is an immaculate, if he's a creation, then he might be a miracle. It could go along with what you were talking about, the skeletons. Which
is
a great book.
Yes.
I'm looking forward to looking at it. I might be the first one.
Oh.
You know, the first man to, like, give birth to 7 children.
That could be. It could be.
Seven.
What do you think about my question? What do you think? Is there anything that you would do for money? Is there a drop-off line for you? Could I give you $1 million and ask you to do, I don't know, damage?
I think what is relevant,
yeah.
And because I think we need to, like, up the ante in regards to the sincerity and the seriousness of pedophilia.
Ah, yes.
Because between Michael and R. Kelly, and so on and so forth, they had a fetish.
Yes.
And the parents, and what really angered me about the R. Kelly interview, even with when he went with Michael, because at the end of the day, they both beat a case.
Yes.
So these are the things that we need to be worried about. Those are the profound words that I like to hear.
Yes.
They beat a case because they had money. So the dude that was just on before me, it was true. However, what's sick to me about the whole entire situation is that people without money, that human trafficking is very real.
Right. What do you think, Gerald? Let me ask you this. So I understand what your points about pedophilia, but there is also, as my previous caller said, there's this lure of glamour, but there's also this lure of money. The parents, and I'm not just picking on the parents of the Michael Jackson kids, but there are parents that allow their kids or allow themselves to do things. Allow them. There's a weakness there somewhere. What do you think about that?
Yes, sir. And in regards to that, and you use the operative word, you use the word weakness. So what I had to say to a couple of my friends that, you know, they're like, oh, how can you say that? Well, because it's reality. And let's speak truth. I'd rather, as a parent, And you know that children, teenagers, you have one, you know, and they're promiscuous. They're getting into that genre of promiscuity. Now, this is what I said, and it might sound crass, but I'd rather have my 17-year-old daughter dealing with a half-behind rock star and being kept than dealing with Rollo down the street that sells drugs out of a trap house.
Yes.
I mean, these are like the harsh realities that you would have to like deal with eventually.
Right.
Now, is there an ethic aspect? Absolutely. And for the age, with Michael and the ages, absolutely. But yes, at the end of the day, these parents sold their children out, hoping that this could be the crossroad for them to get their own little star kinship in the movies or what have you. And or they just needed the house paid off.
Right, I got you. Yeah.
But I thank you for the topic.
Thank you so much for calling. I do appreciate it. This is WMNF. It's Midpoint with me, Norman B. Or Radioactivity, actually. We'll get to Midpoint in a little while. Telephone number, 813-239-9663. Text messages to 813-433-0885. I got a text in from somebody that said he picked up on my saying, what would it cost to damage the boss's car? Would it take $1 million? And he writes in and says, four times the cost of the car. Let's go to another call. Let's talk to Samson in Tampa. Good afternoon, Samson. How are you doing?
Good. How are you?
Good, thank you. What's going on?
I just wanted to comment on your question on whether what would it take, you know, for me to accept money for doing some that.
Yeah.
So my response is really about, it depends, because if somebody offers me a large sum of cash to, let's say, sleep with somebody, my analysis would be like, you know, is it like two consenting adults? It really has to do with like what the act is.
Yes.
And whether the person that's involved is an adult. Or so, you know, defining what morality is.
Yes. Yes, no, you make a very good point there, and I think that is an excellent point indeed. Samson, thank you for your call. Now, let's try and have another one. Get as many in as we can here. Here's Howard in St. Petersburg. Howard, good afternoon. Is it afternoon yet? I'm going forward here, aren't I? It's still morning, apparently. Yeah, Howard.
Hello.
Hello, Howard. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great. You know what I would do for a lot of money?
What would you do?
I would get in the ring with Mike Tyson.
Oh, goodness. You're a brave man.
Yes, and I'm only 155 pounds.
So how much money would that take then? Howard, how much money could we put you in the ring with Mike Tyson? Because I don't think you'd be there for very long.
You know what? I'm cheap, so I'd go $100,000?
Whoa! Your hospital bills are going to be more than that. You know that, don't you?
Oh, I know, because he's going to take me out.
Right. Howard, thank you for your call. Do appreciate it. We're talking about how much money this morning. What would it take? What would you do? Is there a price that we could buy you for to do anything? Let's talk to Mike in Tampa. Good afternoon, Mike.
Hi. I got a quick question.
Yes.
When did WMNF become TMZ?
That's a good question. Thank you for your call, Mike. Tony in Sarasota, let's hear from you.
Hey, how you doing?
I'm doing well. How are you doing today?
I'm fantastic. I got a tad bit of an oddball, what would it take kind of question.
Yeah.
Is that a suggestion? Is that okay?
That's quite fine, yes.
All right. What would it take for somebody to vote for Donald Trump?
Whoa, now that.
Right?
Oh, my goodness. You've opened up what they say is a proverbial can of worms there. Do you think there's a price for that, Tony?
I don't know. That's I don't know. It'd have to be an incredibly high price.
It would, wouldn't it? Yeah. Yeah, I agree with you.
The repercussions of that.
Right. Yeah. Do you think that we are living in a time now where it's got to this kind of craziness where people can be bought for doing something that they know is wrong?
I think, unfortunately, it's always been that way. And I hate to sound like a pessimist.
Mm.
But, you know, I mean, coercions always exist that I would assert, but
yeah.
I think that, you know, we just know more about it through, you know, social media and, you know, technology in general, so we hear about it more.
Right. Yeah. Tony, I really appreciate your call. Thank you. It's a good question. I really appreciate that. Let's talk to Chris in Tampa. What do you think, Chris?
Hello?
Hello.
Hello, how are you?
Well, right now I'm fine. How about you?
I'm fine.
Good, we got that out of the way. So what do you think? How much money can we pay you, Chris, to do something? Okay, let's talk to Charles in Tampa. Charles, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, sir. Yeah, I have something that I would like to do. I'd like to spend a few, maybe 10, 12 hours a day in front of the White House calling for global peace and prosperity.
Yeah.
And with Project 222, it's a nonprofit that calls that everyone should have dignified access within civil society to a minimum of 2 gallons of clean water a day, 2,000 calories a day, and 200 cubic feet of shelter. So I'm going to go up to D.C. in fact Monday, and we'll put signs in front of the White House, 222, me too, and 222, the real New Deal. And that's an anti-nuclear vigil that's been there since 1981. During the Occupy movement, I spent a few months there, 12 hours a day, helping the founder of that, or the one of the founders. And I don't know if you're familiar with that, but for $222, I'll spend time there for the next 3 days. But when we leave, just like WMNF, a good fundraiser for them is T-shirts, we'll be making T-shirts Project 222. We just had a benefit in Cameroon that the shirts came out nice, and we had medicines and food that went over there.
Yeah.
And we also have a great musician that I'd love to send you a demo on that's from Cameroon that wrote a song. It's very nice.
I appreciate it. I appreciate you letting us know about that and taking the time to call us. I want to read out, thank you so much. I want to read out a text message that we received from Anita, and she says, she's talking about the Michael Jackson documentary, and she says, the parents seem to have sold their children, in quotes. I think the parents are as despicable as Mr. Jackson was, she says. And she's sending that message from the Virgin Islands via her phone. I love that. I love it when we get calls and messages from people all over the place. I really like that. Unfortunately, we're coming up to the top of the hour, which means we've got news, and we're going to just try and squeeze in a couple more calls here, see if we can find out who's on the line here. Telephone number 813-239-9663, and our text message number is 813-433-0885, and of course you can email me at dj@wmnf.org. I want to tell you about what's coming up in the next hour. We're going to be talking about women's suffrage. I have the most amazing guest coming on. She has written and edited the most remarkable books. She's a wonderful speaker. We're going to be talking about women's suffrage coming up just after the news at the top of the hour with Sally Roche Wagner. You're just going to be amazed by this lady. She's just absolutely, she tells you things about the suffrage movement I think you may not be familiar with. Before we go on this side of the top of the hour, let's see, Frank, should we take another call? We've got enough time in here to just squeeze another one in. Let's go to, I don't know, I've got a question mark here, so let's to find out. Hello, who's this? What's your name? Oh, she's still there. Okay, all right. Thank you so much. I appreciate that. All right, you know what I'm going to do, Frank? Because it's got tons of emails and text messages here. I'm going to see. Okay, that one's there. So let's go to the lines then. Okay. Good afternoon. Welcome to WMNF.
Yes, good afternoon. I wanted to know if it was possible I can leave a message. I want to go to Washington. Now,
yes.
That was a good answer.
Yes.
That one makes perfect sense. I will get down with that movement, and I'd like the information.
Okay, well, tell you what to do. Leave your number with my caller, my screen caller, okay? And we'll see if the gentleman that was calling can call her back, and you two can connect up that way. How does that sound?
Absolutely. Thank you, and thank you for the topic, but that one works.
Mary, thank you so very much. Have yourself a lovely Friday, okay?
You too.
Thank you. Bye now. All right, let's meet. As I said, I'm going to go back and see if I can get some messages up here from I'm looking down here, Frank. I'm always sort of a point where I got so many in front of me. Let me see. I can't seem to get it up, Frank. But all right, okay. I tell you what, we've got to get up to the news coming up here in just a moment or two. I want you to stand by because we are going to be talking to Sally Roche Wagner about suffragettes and the movement. We're going to talk about that just after the news. Stay with us at WMNF 88.5.
This is WMNF Tampa, 88.5 on the left side of your dial. Best little radio station on planet Earth. Stay tuned for NPR News.